For those that like titles, the title of the day is The Principle of Two Witnesses. It's a theme that goes really from Genesis through Revelation. Why does God require two witnesses for a thing to be established? Because it is true in testimony of someone being guilty of a deed that requires punishment. It's true in the agreement of land deals, when it's land deals are given in the Bible. It's also true in the disciples were to meet together and to agree and discuss things. The importance of two witnesses is very important. There are certain doctrines in the Bible that have more than two witnesses to them. Verses that aver very strongly that the Ten Commandments are to be kept and others, a similar thing. It's important for us to understand that one person cannot take one verse and establish a doctrine. And oftentimes that has happened to the detriment of that person who becomes convinced they are right. And of course, everybody else then must be wrong. And they end up being shipwrecked spiritually, as the Bible discusses. I want to begin the day in Jude verse 14. You might think, well, that's kind of an odd place to begin a sermon. But Jude 14 tells us something about Enoch. In the early time that we know very little about, what they call the antediluvian world or the before the flood world, we know that it became very evil. We know that there was a generation of seven men in a row who were righteous before God. The indication seems to be that by the time Noah, the seventh of that generation, was an adult and growing, he was the only one left that was righteous in his generations, that the entire rest of the world had turned against God. And, of course, Methuselah was in that generation, and he died the year that the flood took place. However, Jude tells us about a man named Enoch, and it's sort of important because God always gives two witnesses. We all are very familiar with the two witnesses of Revelation chapter 11. If Noah was by himself as the only one warning the ancient world of their evils and the impending judgment, then God would be going against his own principle. But it says here in Jude, verse 14, Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, to convict all who were ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him." What kind of prophecy is this? What kind of warning? Well, it's pretty strong, isn't it? He doesn't just say, "Behold, the Lord is coming with 10,000s of his saints." That's important. And that's something that Job also talks about, and of course is prophesied. Jesus Christ talked about it. It's in Revelation, other places. So the prophecy, the warning message that God has given from the very beginning is the same, that God is coming to judge with 10,000s or millions of his saints and angels, to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds. That sounds like the times in which we live. Those are, speaking of the God haters and the God rejectors and those who parade around sort of thumbing their nose at God's laws and God's requirements. It says, which they have committed in an ungodly way and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. In other words, spoken against the Lord. So, obviously, Enoch was a prophet warning the antediluvian world about their impending judgment that was coming. Noah also warned them. So we could easily say that these then were the first two witnesses to an evil generation that God had used. In fact, let's go back to Genesis chapter 5, because this principle of God establishing truth through two witnesses does go back to the very beginning. Genesis chapter 5 and verse 22. Well, verse 21 says, Enoch lived 65 years and he begat Methuselah. Enoch was the father of Methuselah, who was the longest living human being that we know of in time. And it says, after he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. And all the days of Enoch were 365 years. So he didn't live contemporaneous with Noah. Apparently Noah would have died or would have been born about the time that Enoch was taken and died. But Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech, and he begot Lamech. After he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had sons and daughters. And then he was 969 years old when he died. So we have this lineage that comes down, of course, to Noah. Verse 31, all the days of Lamech were 777 years and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So obviously they lived much longer than we do. I think that most of us would get tired of life if we lived 700 or 900 years, although who knows. As a spirit being, I think would be fine. But in this physical bodies that have challenges and issues and wear out and get tired, I think that 700, 900 years would just be too long. So I've been in the hospital or in the last days with more than one person who has said the really best thing about getting old is you don't mind dying. You know, because there comes a point, you know, my mother was 84 years healthy, and the day she turned 84, it's like her body completely fell apart, and the next 12 months were just a nightmare. You know, she had cancer, she had her back fell apart, she couldn't hardly walk, couldn't stand, in pain all the time. And so we were all sort of not glad to see her go. We were glad she was no longer in pain and suffering, but it's amazing how a person can live that long healthy and then just sort of wake up one day and everything has changed. So we have Lamech and the others, but Noah is the one here that we know was the last of this line, but we at least acknowledge that we also had Enoch as a person who warned or might have been a witness of God's way of life during the time of the pre-flood world. There are other examples we don't need to turn to. Joshua and Zerubbabel were two who went together they came back from captivity, and they both witnessed about what was happening with the people there, that they needed to get their temple finished. And we can talk about a number of others. Elijah and Elisha sometimes are also mentioned as perhaps two men who could be called like the two types of two witnesses. Although Elijah had a warning ministry and warned them about their evils, Elisha kind of had a rebuilding ministry as the people of Israel had a spate of about 80 years there where they actually had peace and followed God for a fairly decent time with good kings. Now, there are many people today that would like to be one of the coming two witnesses. I recall hearing, I didn't hear it, but I heard that Mr. Armstrong claimed that 14 different people over the years had come to him and said they were one of the two witnesses. And that may be, it's probably true. People do get delusional thoughts, delusional hearing, or ideas, and they send them out. I want to go over now to Numbers chapter 35 and verse 30. As God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, he several times gave them principles about government. In fact, much of Deuteronomy and Leviticus and Numbers are about how they were to govern themselves as a physical nation once they entered the land of Canaan. And this is a big mistake a lot of people make. They say, well, we don't do that anymore. We don't stone people for, you know, doing what they do. So that's because those laws applied to a physical nation. Now we are a spiritual nation. The principles of those laws should be followed by modern-day Israel. We don't. We ignore so many of them. But when Israel is once again established, you'll find that these laws will be theirs, and they will keep them as the example for all the world to follow. And my guess is law and order are going to be pretty much in vogue. We won't see a lot of the things we see happening around us today. By the way, just as a side issue, while my memory is not going bad, on this issue, there is a homeless camp about 500 yards that direction on 26th. So I would just warn everybody, please do not put anything in your cars that looks like it's valuable. The smash and grab has been, I think, probably on the increase in Portland. And we were in Tacoma. We actually had to leave a hall there at Jason Lee School because the parking lot would have two or three windows smashed and things taken out. You know, a briefcase might have your Bible and your study notes in it, but a thief doesn't know that. He thinks there must be something valuable in there that he could pawn or sell or something. So be careful as the times change and it's a little darker here in the parking lot. Be sure you don't leave anything of value sitting, you know, clearly in the window in the car out in the parking lot. Nothing's happened so far, but I'm not anticipating that. I just think it would be wise for us to kind of prevent that ahead of time if at all possible. Obviously, the apartments around here are mostly all students from Reed College. So that's pretty safe. And perhaps Reed College has has some security people that drive around once a year. I don't know if they do or not. I'm just guessing. I know at most colleges they do have some security that drives around the dormitories. At any rate, let's continue here. Numbers 35, let's begin in verse 30. It says, "Moreover, whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses. But one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty." Now keep in mind that when Noah landed on Mount Ararat and God gave him some directions as to the new world, he said, a man that sheds blood must have his blood shed by man. And that, of course, shedding blood means death. It doesn't mean cutting your finger. And so the death penalty apparently was not enforced in the pre-flood world. Even Cain, who killed his brother Abel, was not sentenced to death. He was sentenced to essentially exile. But after the flood, God was very clear with Noah that murder must be then carried out with the death penalty. And of course, civil governments, the New Testament is pretty clear that the civil governments are established to execute justice on evildoers, so we understand that. It's not a church responsibility, it is a responsibility for governments. But notice the principle here is there has to be two witnesses. Not one person can make a charge against another and then have that person be punished, especially with a penalty this severe. "Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death." So there shall be no bribes paid, no money paid in advance. Nobody can get out. Doesn't mean if they're related to an important person or if they are somehow exempt in their own eyes. God says they are not. God's word is full of equal justice for all in the eyes of the law. There's no one that is exempt from it or above it. Certainly wish that was the case in our land today, but it's not. Verse 32, "You shall take no ransom for him who has fled to the city of refuge." So it's really talking about somebody who has committed a death. Perhaps it was accidental, perhaps in a fit of rage, perhaps it was planned out. But they could flee to a city of refuge and then have a trial. "So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land." How many times does God say the blood of that murdered person cries out to me? Or Christ told the generation, the first generation, that the blood from the time of Cain all the way, or Abel, until the time of Zacharias would be required of their generation. And so the blood of those who are murdered or injured cries out to God. He says, "Blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land and the blood that is shed on it except by the blood of him who shed it." So nothing can, in God's eyes, requite the blood that is shed in a murder except the person who committed the murder. Verse 34, "Therefore do not defile the land which you inhabit. In the midst of it I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel." So we have here this very important principle that it would take two people, the word of two different witnesses, to make sure that a person was actually guilty. And these two witnesses had to be witnesses, not one person who was a witness who then convinces somebody else to be on their side. It's a great mistake we have allowed to be made in God's church over the centuries, since the last 80 years, is that a person believes he has a charge against somebody, and so he recruits somebody else to be on his side. That's not a second witness. That is an advocate or a supporter at best. And so if we do have principle of two witnesses, it asks us to be two people who actually witnessed with their own eyes the crime that was committed. So be careful that you don't confuse a recruited subordinate or supporter and confuse that with the term witness. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, another place where the two witness principle is mentioned. God gave it to the Israelites actually in three different places. It's that important to him. And I think since it's that important, we need to make sure that we are following that in our own lives also. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 6 says this, "Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death." And so we have the person who makes the accusation or saw it happen had to be the first one to throw a stone. And afterwards, the hands of all the people. so shall you put away evil from among you. Now, notice how this justice is to be administered. If a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge, between degrees of guilt for bloodshed. Now, that happens often. How many times have you heard about a crime or something being done, and then you think, the more you look into it, the more it gets, oh, there's this side of the story, and what about that, and on it goes. And in our system, we have been very creative about blaming everything except the perpetrator of the crime. You can blame his background, say he stubbed his toe when he was 3, the cat scratched him when he was 9, he had a bad dream when he was, I'm making all these up, but I'm not exaggerating much. There's a book called The Nation of Victims that lists all of these things that have been, these arguments that have been made in court to justify crimes, in some cases very violent crime that was committed. And they are, remember the Twinkie defense? Who was it, the guy that killed somebody and said that he ate too many Twinkies and it gave him a sugar high and he committed some crime? It's been years and years ago. Most of you are probably too young to remember it. Anyway, we have here a principle in the Bible is very similar, very simple to understand. Two or more witnesses. Verse 8, if a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge. Oftentimes matters are difficult. They require diligent study, diligent investigation. Between degrees of guilt for bloodshed, between one judgment or another, or between one punishment or another, matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses. And that, of course, is where the priests were, because the priests and the Levites were then the ultimate judges. You shall come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge there in those days, and inquire of them. So they knew that when they came into the promised land, see, the system that God set up for national government was that God was going to be in charge. And of course, every family had their own property, they had their own land, and landmarks could not be moved. If for some reason they went into bankruptcy or lost the land, every 50 years the land was restored, every 7 years debts were forgiven, and land Sabbath. And so in his society, we had judges who lived in cities of refuge and other places. And the Levites and the priests were to teach the cities all across Israel, where the Levites were to then read the words of Moses and teach people. But eventually, the Israelites, of course, didn't do that. And so in the time of Samuel, God told them, Samuel, they've not rejected you, they've rejected me, that I should rule over them. So in a correct organization for a nation, there is individual ownership of land by the families. There are judges that are appointed by God or allowed to be appointed by God. There are Levites that would teach the truth, but God was the ruler or is the ruler of the land. God is the ultimate authority. So verse 9 says to go to one of those places where there's a judge and inquire of them, and they shall pronounce sentence upon the judgment. You shall do according to the sentence which they pronounce upon you in that place which the Lord chooses, and you shall be careful to do according to all that is done for you. So we have people that were required to go to the judge, and they were then to honor the decision that was made by the judge and the Levites. They were not to be arguing with it or saying it's simply not going to be done. And of course, the Levites had to make diligent inquiry. They couldn't just have some personal reason for doing that. So it required the things that were, first place, the testimony of two witnesses. The witnesses had to be the first ones to throw stones. But now let's go over one more chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15. Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any inquiry or any sin that he commits. How many times have you known of one witness accusing somebody of something and it turns into a big national fiasco? Probably think of a couple in recent times. A man named Clarence Thomas, a man by all accepted standards of quality, a very fine individual, scholar of the law, had one woman with no corroborating evidence whatsoever came forward, embarrassed the whole nation for about 2 weeks, embarrassed Mr. Thomas, finally found out that everything she said was manufactured, made up. More recent times, a judge named Brett Kavanaugh was nominated. One woman from California who gave a completely false testimony, which we know it was false, She had no friend. No, nobody corroborated it. Nobody else who was there said it was true. She got up and swore before Congress that the trauma had made her afraid of flying on airplanes. And she had this boyfriend she'd lived with for 14 years, documented 100 and some plane flights they'd taken together, many in small little planes over in the South Pacific, going out to see various sites. So when that was brought forward, guess what happened to her? She disappeared. And he was confirmed, but it was a single witness with a dishonest accusation, and it caused horrible damage to our legal system and to a fine man who was nominated to be a justice of the Supreme Court. Now, those are two very public, well-known, and you might say high-profile examples. But have we not allowed that to happen among ourselves sometimes, where one person comes and gives an accusation against somebody, and then you, meaning this guy in the mirror here, believe it? One of the very first pieces of advice I was given by David Mills when I was hired by the church in 1982, he was a very wonderful man, a man of great wisdom, and I cherish those 3 years I spent with him. One of the first things he said to me was, Rex, don't let anyone sic you on somebody else. They loved to do that in the ministry. And, of course, the Salem church, everybody interrelated. They were all cousins, nephews, and aunts, and uncles, and brothers. And they all had these family feuds going on. And none of you have family feuds, I know that. But they did. And they would try to involve the minister coming over and solve this family feud. And, of course, you would hear all sorts of stories. And I'd say, I'm sorry, we don't get involved in divorces. We don't get involved in family feuds. I had a little sister. Anybody have a little sister? What do little sisters do to big brothers? Well, my little sister would, if I was sitting on the couch, she would come over when she was 5 or 4 or whatever, and I was 8 or 9, and she would hit me with a book, and I would run after her, and she'd read, Mom, Rex is killing me. Mom, Rex is trying to hit me. And, of course, Mom, who's in the kitchen doing dishes, what will she do? She would yell at me to sit down. If you don't hit her, I'll hit you. So the parents are often victims for this accusation. One person accuses, sibling accusations, whatever. I've always admired when raising children, my wife could always rise above that. She didn't react to the single accusation that one sibling might make against another. It happens in every family. I'm not saying it's evil. What I'm saying is we need to understand that we should not just react to one accusation made by one person because it's not godly. God knows human nature, and so we put this in here for our good. So one witness shall not rise against another concerning any inquiry or any sin that he commits. It's very important we understand that we have to apply this administratively in our families and also in the church. Too often accusations have been made against ministers or against people in the church by one person who has a judge acts to grind. Maybe the accusation was correct, but unfortunately there was not enough following of these biblical principles done, and we have some scars from our past by the way people were treated because this was not done correctly. Notice it says, by the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses the matter shall be established. This is not a capital crime of being executed for here. This is simply any matter. If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord. This is really important. Both people, the accuser and the accused, stand before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. You see, in God's word, there is no witness protection program. But how many of us have been accused anonymously? Well, it's come back to me that you've said you've done this. Well, who said that? That's not true. Well, we can't tell you who said that. Well, why not? Why not? Probably they haven't acted. Well, they're afraid of you. Wait a minute. The Bible doesn't say they can say, I'm afraid of somebody. We used to have a saying in Worldwide back in the ministry. I served 13 years in the Worldwide full-time ministry. And the saying was, it's interesting, that was, two things. If you get a call from Pasadena, get on your knees first and say a prayer that God would give you favor in their sight before you start the conversation, which I did several times because it was always calling to transfer or because this day happened or that had happened. But then the second saying we had was, they will never call you until you're already swinging from a rope. Word for word. You get a call after your quick prayer, oh, we're transferring you to New York City. Why? I've only been here 2 years, doing good. Well, a few people have complained, you know, and we just think, well, who? What do they say? Well, we can't say we're protecting them, and so you just got to pack up and move. Very ungodly, very wrong, and it caused a number of people I knew in the ministry to quit because of the pathetic administration, the HR policies, you might say, or HR abuse that went on in our earlier years. I'm very thankful United has tried to change that. And they honestly have. They've made a sincere effort to not do things that way, to treat our employees with respect and appreciation, and make sure that all sides of the story are heard before anything is believed or done. And I was on the council for 6 years and saw that happen in spades, so I can say that's really true. We also have a written code of ethics that every minister has to sign and live by. And those two things, I believe, set us apart from the other Church of God groups. No other Church of God group that I know of has any sort of a code of ethics that all ministers have to sign and agree in their signature to abide by. So I think it's a statement of you know, faith. We can have faith and we can have some trust in the organization that I think is on a godly line. Now, let's continue on here. The principle is if someone is accused, the accuser and the accused stand before the judges. Notice verse 18, the judges shall make careful inquiry. Now, what does that mean? That means no quick judgments. That means you hear every side of the story, and then you try to find out any other sort of evidence that might be there that would corroborate one way or another. And sometimes there is other things that come out. Who has testified falsely against his brother. So if you find a false witness has come forward, you shall do to him as he thought to do to his brother. Says, so shall you put away the evil from among you. Now, if this were carried out today, there would be a lot less accusing going on in our society. If people who made false accusations had to then pay the penalty they were trying to cause to others, you would find there'd be a whole lot less dishonesty and a whole lot less of the accusations that we sometimes hear in the political world or the news, whatever it might be. So the important principle is this. We need to make sure we follow this principle, that we do not let one person accuse another and then just immediately accept it all as true and carry out some sort of penalty, that instead there is the principle of the accused and the accused together standing before the judges, and secondly, that diligent inquiry is to be made before any sort of decision is carried out. Then we have verse 21, too. Your eye shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. So when the penalty is determined because a judgment of guilty has been given, it's not a time for, you know, leniency, mercy, just let them get away with it. Perhaps they'll be rehabbed. Perhaps it was the hamburger they ate that caused them to do it. I wish I was exaggerating, but I'm not. In our society, we've gotten away from verse 21 about as far as we can. Capital murder sometimes gets a person 7 years in prison. And I've been in enough major prisons to know when the guys know they can get out. They know how many days it'll be, and they can get life in prison, but if they have good behavior, sometimes it's no more than 12 years, and they are able to go out and do it again. So I used to visit, when I was in Salem, we had four prisons in Salem the years I was there. I think they still have them. But they had the OSCI, which was out on Mission Street, that was for kind of sort of the first or second offenders. But the really bad guys were OSP in downtown Salem. And we used to get a lot of letters from prisoners that wanted visits. So one time I got this letter from, it was sent normally to Pasadena, and they would send it back up. Just absolutely beautiful handwriting. It's one of the most beautiful cursive writing I've ever seen. And the guy wanted to visit, so I would write them a letter and say, please send me a letter containing your biography, or your life history, what you're in for, how long you'll be in, you know, where you grew up, your family life. And so about half of them wouldn't write back, so that saved me ever having to go try to visit with them. But this guy wrote me this beautiful letter, beautiful handwritings, back 6 pages, and on it goes. And he originally was from Africa, but he was over here, and on. He was really wanting, I thought, well, this guy maybe has some potential. You know, most of them don't, but this guy I thought really had some potential. So I made a call, and I went down an appointment and went down to OSP, and they make you essentially take all your clothes off, have your underwear, then go through all your pockets, and then anything you might have goes in a locker. Then they still go over you with these wands. And then you wait in this little chamber for a while. Then you finally go out in the visiting room, and you're assigned to because these are all the lifers. These are the really hard time guys. And so then they assign you a table, and then you wait for a while, and then they go in, down in the prison, and they escort the guy you're going to visit coming out. So I was alone in this room with probably 25 tables, and they bring in this guy that would make Shaquille O'Neal look small. I have never seen any piece of humanity this large before, and I did walk, one time I walked down a hallway and brushed Arvydas Sabonis at a chiropractor office, because our chiropractor was also the Blazers chiropractor. But this guy was massive, massive, huge guy. And he sat down, and I said, oh, I told him I appreciated his letter and asked him, and he looked at me and he said, of course, I knew this guy could just go like this, and I'd be dead. He could squash me like a bug. And do you know why I asked you to come here? And I said, well, I assume you want to learn more about the Bible, and I can tell you about what the Bible teaches, and then we can talk about some basic doctrines. No, I don't care about that. I want you to ordain me the apostle to Uganda and get me out of here. This was not in his letter, and it wasn't what I wanted to hear. And so I'm sitting there kind of shaking at my knees. Okay, if I tell him I'm not going to ordain you an apostle, is he just going to kill me or do bodily harm? And I knew that the guards were so far away they could never protect me and get there in time. So I prayed for wisdom and tried to make some small talk and, you know, reason around. But he was very insistent on me ordaining him the apostle to Uganda so he could get and getting him out of there, which was not on my list of things to do to help him get out of prison. So after about an hour, I finally got up and said goodbye and went away. And I think he went away with the impression that he had won the battle and I was going to get him out and ordain him an apostle to Uganda. But he was disappointed because that never happened. I never went back in there. But having been there in Walla Walla and a few other places, the ones in the prisons, they know who the murderers are. They all know what everybody else is in for. And sometimes it can be a very, very bad experience. Now, having said all of that, if we actually carried out verse 21, we would not have this massive prison problem we have in this country. First place, murder would only be committed once by any person. And secondly, it would be a fear factor, and so our murder rate would go way down. By the way, the murder rate in Portland and many other major cities has skyrocketed the last 2 years, up like 30-40%. Let's go over to the book of Ruth. This is an example of the two-witness principle being carried out. You are all very familiar with this, I think, because we all like the book of Ruth. It's one of the more colorful and, I think, enjoyable books to read. Yeah, let me go. Ruth chapter 4. Now, what we have here is a concerned landowner. And to break in the middle of the story, this was land that had been owned by Naomi's husband. And so the next of kin who could then marry Ruth would be this landowner. But if he married her and then she had a son, it was going to rock the boat of his inheritance plan. Sometimes this happens in modern day where there's a second marriage in a family and they have additional children. And then the first children, you know, there's, you know, who gets to inherit mom and dad's estate? Those issues. Well, that's what was going to be happening here. And this doesn't give the guy's name, but it just says the one who was the relative, the close relative, said, no, I do not want to claim Naomi. I don't want to claim Naomi or Ruth because it will mess up my inheritance plan and my current family. And so then he had to go before the court of the land, which was at the city gates, and both of them had to affirm in front of witnesses. In this case, Boaz, you got to admire Boaz here as far as a romantic. I think most people think Boaz wasn't very romantic. After all, he's sleeping, all of a sudden wakes up at night and there's this girl at his feet. But Boaz brought 12 witnesses. So he was really wanting to do this right. He could have brought two, but he brought 12 witnesses. He wanted to impress upon Ruth that he really did want to marry her. So I'm sure she felt good about that. So it's kind of like the old joke about, you know, how many cows in Africa where they trade cows for women, apparently for brides. But at any rate, let's go to Ruth chapter 4, verse 1. Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. Behold, the close relative, that's all he's called, of whom Boaz had spoken, came by. So Boaz said, come aside, friend, sit down. So he came aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city. So not two witnesses, he took 10. and said, sit down. So they did. Then he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no doubt but you want to redeem it, for I am next after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, because her husband would have been legally the owner of the land now, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. So the land then that would have been would have gone back to whatever son Ruth would have had, and the name of the child would have had to have been through Ruth's former husband. And so a close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself. In modern day terms, this is going to cause family problems for me, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem it. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So there were 12 men here, 10 witnesses plus the two men, the close relative and Boaz. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, so the other witnesses could say, yes, I saw this relative take off his sandal and give it to Boaz. Verse 8, therefore the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he took off his sandal. So the sandal symbolized the title to the land that he was now giving to Boaz. So Boaz said to the elders of the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's in the hand of Naomi, or from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren, from his position at the gate. You are witnesses to this day. All the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. They agreed to that. The Lord said, make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. So there was a blessing that was given to them, to Ruth and Boaz. You know, this principle of two witnesses on a will is still, we still do it today. One of the few biblical principles I think we still carry out. If you have a will done, you have to have two people witness it, notarized, that are not named in the will. They cannot be relatives. They cannot be people named in the will. Normally, a legal office just has two of their secretaries, and they watch you sign it, and they sign it, and it's notarized, and you're done. So we do have the same principle as was carried out here in this account in the book of Ruth. So Boaz certainly honored her by having that number of witnesses and making sure that the deal was done publicly and above board. Now I want to go over to Luke chapter 10 and verse 1, because Jesus Christ, when he sent the disciples out, he sent them out two by two on their very first missionary journey, if you want to call it that. They were on a mission and they were on a journey, so it's not really wrong to call it a missionary journey. The interesting question here in Luke 10, you may not have thought of this before, was how many of these guys were sent out? There are three ideas or three thoughts that are supported in various commentaries and by various Bible scholars. Verse 1, chapter 10. After these things, the Lord appointed 70 others also and sent them two by two before his face into every city and place where he himself wanted them to go. Now here's the controversy. Did he send 70 in addition to the 12, making a total of 82? So it would have been 41 pairs of preachers going out. That's a possibility. However, in the last part of chapter 9, Peter and James are specifically mentioned. So perhaps it was, or I'm sorry, James and John were specifically mentioned, verse 54. So perhaps the other 70 added up to 72. You would have had Peter and John, or James and John, plus these other 70. So you would have had a total of 72 or 36 pairs of men going out. The final number is that these 70 are in addition to all the 12. The other 70 are other than the 12, so it would have been a total of 82 or 41 pairs that were sent out. The third thing is that the total was 70, would have been 35 pairs, and there are some commentaries that support that. So I have no answer. I have no idea other than between 70 and 82. I'll put it that way. So who knows what the best guess is. But it does say that he sent them out two by two before his face into every city and place where he himself was about to go. So they went through Judea, Samaria, up into the area of Tyre and Sidon, perhaps a few other places where he went that we don't have record of. But he went to prepare their, they were like John the Baptist on a shorter journey, but they had the same type of a commission, that they were to go every place where he was going to go. Another place says that he sent them to the cities of Israel, but not to any other cities. So they were to be preaching, they were to be healing the sick, and preparing the place for them to go. Let's see, go down to verse 8, whatever city you enter, and they receive you, eat such things as are set before you. Heal the sick, and say to them, the kingdom of God has come near to you. Slightly different than John the Baptist's message, but also very similar. Whatever city you enter, and they do not receive you, go out into its streets and say, the very dust of your city which clings to us, we wipe off against you. Nevertheless, know that the kingdom of God has come near you, or the opportunity to be in God's kingdom is coming. Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is on the earth, and he's coming. But I say to you that it will be more tolerable in that day for Sodom than for that city. So we have these people going out, but notice it was not individuals, it was pairs, two men. It was the principle of two witnesses to establish a truth. Now, part of the reason for this may be that Palestine at this time had a fairly long series, and they are recorded in history, of one man proclaiming, I'm the Messiah types. I think that perhaps Satan the devil inspired that to happen in the years, beginning in about the year, probably about 20 BC. You can look in Josephus and some other accounts, but there's a man named Simon and one named Judas and several others that proclaim themselves to be the Messiah and led little revolts against the Romans. And so perhaps having two men going out and saying, no, the real Messiah is coming now, was a kind of a way of making sure there wasn't a single person again or wasn't going to be in that same ilk. So let's continue here down in chapter 10. We have these two by two men that went out. It says in verse 18, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven, because they returned and said, Lord, even the demons are subject to us. He says, behold, I give you the authority to trample on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. So here we have Christ not only supporting them while they were out, supernaturally, of course, when they came back, he told them that they had done a good job, essentially, and they were thrilled that the spirits had been subject to them, and hopefully they were more thrilled that people had responded to their message and were anxiously waiting for Jesus Christ to come. So it kind of helps us understand why there were crowds of 5,000 and 7,000 that followed Christ later, because there would have been a lot of talk about this is the Messiah is coming, and of course with the miracles, what they did would have been very convincing. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. For time-wise, we may just have time to get through this section, and we'll pick it up later next time. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 15. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. Now, hopefully this works very well between two converted people, and the one who is going is also aware of his own imperfections and perhaps faults in the matter. But if both are clothed with humility, which we are supposed to be, then Jesus Christ guarantees us that it would work out well. It says, if he will not hear you, if he hears you, then you've gained your brother. If he will not hear you, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. So he's literally here quoting Deuteronomy 17. But notice it has to be witnesses, not just somebody you recruit to go there and witness what the other person's reaction might be, or to go there as your support. So you have to find somebody else who would be a witness of the things that have been done, or whatever the controversy is. If he refuses to hear them, So the other person says, yes, I saw you do this, or yes, I heard you do that, so, you know, please, it isn't healthy, it isn't Christian, whatever. If he refuses to hear the church, then let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. So we have, you know, kind of a controversy, and Christ is telling us how to handle controversies and potential offenses that might come up. Verse 18, assuredly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth will be bound in heaven. But notice, it still has to be at the mouth of two witnesses. Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. So again, even in making decisions of a church nature like this, and also in things we ask of God and ask him to bind and loose, it still requires the principle of two witnesses, or two that agree to it. So here we have, I think a very important principle. The context is interesting here, because the context is lost sheep. Verse 10, take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. The Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. Do you think if a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, he does not leave the 99 and go to the mountains and seek the one that was straying? So here we have a context of what this is all about, essentially, before this comes up, is a context of lost sheep. And then it goes on to the context of what we talked about, going to your brother, which, of course, Christ answered by quoting Deuteronomy chapter 17. So even in prayer, there needs to be a second witness. Now, let's wait, time for a little bit more. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 26 and verse 57. The Jews knew they required two witnesses. The Romans did not. The Romans were very good at carrying out capital punishment and all sorts of evil things on the basis of rumor, on the basis of an accusation, on the whim of somebody. The proscriptions carried out in time of, to begin with, of Octavian, and then, of course, later under Nero and others, where they would just write names on a board in Rome, and anybody could kill them. There was a death penalty with no trial, with no evidence, just a name written on a piece of paper by somebody who was in power. So Augustus was the first one to do it. That was the Roman way. Just one person can accuse, and they carry out execution or some sort of punishment, and that was it. It's not God's way at all. So in Matthew chapter 26, verse 57, this is the account, of course, of Christ's arrest and betrayal. Those who had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. This is right after the Garden of Gethsemane arrest. And Peter followed him a distance to the high court's yard, or high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death. They knew they could not condemn him to death and give him over to the Romans except at the hand of two witnesses. But they found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they were either bribed or coerced by the Jews, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward. So they finally scrambled around enough trying to find two false witnesses. And they said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. Now that's not really what he said. What he really said is over in John chapter 2 and verse 13. And what he said was, this temple will be destroyed, or you destroy it, meaning the temple of his body, and that it would be his body, or he would be raised up within 3 days. That's John chapter 2 and verse 13. It says, let's drop all the way down to verse 19. Jesus answered and said to them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And the Jews said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple. How can you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So he said, you destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. The false witnesses said, this fellow says, I am able to destroy this temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And the high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? Because Christ did not answer false accusations. He did not answer slander. He did answer sincere questions when they were given by Pilate, you know, what is truth, and other questions that he asked, where did you come from? But the bottom line here is the Jews knew they required two witnesses, and they had to have two witnesses before they could pass some sort of judgment. It'd be interesting to hear the real stories that could have come out about Christ's miracles and raising from the dead and feeding 5,000 and 7,000 and others. But of course, the Sanhedrin put a lot of pressure, political pressure, against the truth coming out. But that's typical of how Satan works. Now, the temple was sacred. Let's go over to, well, here in verse 61 of this chapter, Matthew 26. Yes, I'm able to destroy the temple. But Jeremiah chapter 7, and we'll just mention that. Let's go over to Acts 6. But Jeremiah chapter 7 is a key scripture that says that the temple of God was sacred and that nobody could speak against it or do anything against it. So they worship the building more than the laws or the God who gave those laws and made that building possible. Over in Acts chapter 6 and verse 13, there's a proof of that here in Stephen's speech. It says, they also set up false witnesses who said, this man does not seek to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law. So when they were trying to accuse Stephen, a deacon who was full of faith in verse 8 and did great wonderful things as the church had been established or in the days after the church was established in Jerusalem, so they also found false witnesses to speak against him. Now, Stephen's response here in chapter 7 is kind of an amazing thing, because what he says sort of verifies what they said, in the sense. He says, verse 14, we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us. Now, Christ never said he would destroy the temple. What he said was the Romans would come and take away their nation and their place because they were disobeying God. But if you look down and see what Stephen actually said that made them so mad, it's kind of interesting. Chapter 7 and verse 48, after a very long speech, very well done, a lot of obviously solid knowledge of Old Testament history. Verse 48, Stephen said, however, the Most High does not dwell in temples made with hands. And he gave a psalm, as the prophet says, that heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. And so this made them very, very mad, because he spoke not against the temple, but against their belief that God did not, or that God dwelt only in the temple. He said, no, God does not dwell in temples made with hands, but in the hearts of people. And of course, verse 54, when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed on him with their teeth and eventually stoned him. So they've had false witnesses against Christ. They brought in false witnesses against Stephen. And of course, false witnesses are a tool of Satan the devil that will be used against all people, all Christians in all time. But let's go over to, I'm going to finish today in 2 Timothy chapter 2. What we need to draw from all of this biblical knowledge, and there's some more we'll cover next time, about the principle of two witnesses, is that in your life, you need to have two witnesses that you are a sincere Christian, that you're living a sincere life, that you are not missing out or doing something superficial. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19 gives us two proofs. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19. Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal. If something is sealed, it can only be opened by the one it's addressed to. In other words, we are sealed for God. We are sealed to someday be in the resurrection. And the seal of God is this: the Lord knows those who are his. In other words, they're led by the Spirit of God. The Lord knows those because they have his Spirit. And let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. And those are the two witnesses that you are truly in God's family, and that you are headed for his kingdom and the resurrection, that you have, that God knows that you are his through his Holy Spirit, and that you are making effort in this life to depart from iniquity and follow God with all of your heart. So those two witnesses we need to look at, examine our life from time to time, and say, do I truly have the seal of God? Because those two witnesses are required to establish that truth. So next time we'll finish some more on this and continue with our study of the two witnesses, or at least the principle of two witnesses being required in God's word.